I blame the Lovecraft. I blame Cthulhu.
Nice.
On our Skype session today.
Oh, look at you.
Hi, guys.
You are all musical and ready for this.
You don't know what's going to happen.
That's true. Yeah. No. When you're talking about HP, it's all up in the air.
Oh, trust me, I know. I was employed by them for ages.
Okay.
So, Nikki, you just watched From Beyond?
Yeah.
That was your prep for this? From Beyond?
It's the only one that I hadn't seen in forever and didn't remember, and it turns out there's a reason I didn't remember it.
So you didn't like it?
I want my life back.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about that during the podcast.
Yeah, all right. Let's get going.
Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the Gentlemen Nerds. The Gentlemen Nerds are four entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about geeky and nerdy things, mostly in the vein of film, television, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many, many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemennerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. The nethermost caverns are not for the fathoming of eyes that see, for their marvels are strange and terrific. Curse the ground where the dead thoughts live, new and oddly bodied, and evil the mind that is held by no head. For it is of old rumor that the soul of the devil brought hastes not from his charnel clay, but fats and instructs the very worm that gnaws, till out of corruption horrid life springs, and the dull scavengers of earth wax crafty to vex it, and swell monstrous to plague it. Great holes secretly are digged, where earth's pores ought to suffice, and things have learnt to walk that ought to crawl. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Lobot Lounge.
Well done.
Just practicing for my one-man H.P. Lovecraft show. This is the Gentlemen Nerds. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge. Pardon the candles and the dim light and the satanic-looking area. I promise nothing bad's happening here. We're preparing to talk about H.P. Lovecraft. And when we talk about Lovecraft, folks, we got to get in that mood. So pardon that theatrical bit there. H.P. Lovecraft, the inspiration for many, many television, film adaptations. Lovecraftian has become a word that's bandied about very easily and simply. But one of the Gentlemen Nerds, Aaron D'Orive, had an idea to talk about this because somebody had asked, what exactly is Lovecraftian? And we're going to talk about that. I've got the book, I've got the candles. I think we're going to have a good time tonight, and hopefully no one gets possessed by anything bad. Here around the table in the dim light is Mickey Finn.
Do you read Sutter Kane?
Mark Finn.
Let's get tentacled. Tentacled. Ooh. I want to get tentacled.
Yeah.
Trap me in your pentacle.
Wow.
Nice.
Let me hear your mana talk.
I always thought this was a Japanese animation coverage you were doing here, but that is something different. And of course, the guy who started it all, Aaron D'Orive.
Let's not forget that is not dead, which can eternal lie, and with strange aeons, even death may die.
Amen to that. So what? My God, H.P. Lovecraft. Everyone goes, oh yeah, H.P. Lovecraft. That's that spooky guy. But it's so much more than that. It's so much deeper than that.
And it's especially now, I think it's back in sort of the public consciousness because so many of the very excellent media creators, filmmakers and television showmakers are really sort of really embracing the feel, the tone. In fact, what Joseph just said, what is Lovecraftian? There's a lot of Lovecraftian shows that are being promoted and pushed. I mean, we just saw the trailer for Stranger Things 2, speaking of Lovecraftian. Yeah. And so, yeah, I think it's back. I think it came and went in waves. You know, we had our vampire wave, our werewolf wave, our zombie wave. I still think we're still in that. And Lovecraft now, sort of, I think Lovecraft has really hit sort of a peak interest point to me, from what I can see on TV and such. But I don't know. I mean, how should we do this, Joseph? Do you want to start with...
what I would like to do, and because there might be some of our listeners who are unfamiliar with Howard Phillips Lovecraft, other than just a reference. Or they may have had exposure to Lovecraft or references to Lovecraft, like the Necronomicon, but not know exactly where that came from. Yep. And go, oh, isn't that book from Evil Dead? Yes, it is. But there's more to it, folks. So I would like to maybe start with a brief, mind you, history of who H.P. Lovecraft was. And to do this, I turn, as I usually do, to my brother from another mother, Mark Finn.
Well, thank you, Joseph. H.P. Lovecraft was a pulp writer who was born in 1890, and he is best remembered as the author of what has become to be known as the Cthulhu mythos. Now, Lovecraft, yeah, he was the guy that invented Cthulhu. For those of you who have seen the countless memes and plushies and things like that. Now, Lovecraft was a really smart guy. And you know, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth. He essentially was – I don't want to throw him under the bus. He was an interesting fellow, and he had a kind of a unique set of circumstances that put him living off of an inheritance that his parents had built with two aunts in Providence, Rhode Island. And he was a voracious letter writer and an amateur journalist and an amateur astronomer and self-taught, very smart guy. And so he wrote for amateur presses and sent stories out for it to pulp magazines and engendered a lot of correspondence with people. His most famous correspondent and literary friend was Robert E. Howard. Yeah. And the two of them had a voluminous correspondence that has been collected and studied, takes them to both of them to the end of their life. He died in 1937 at a young age of I want to say it was pancreatic cancer, but I don't think it was cancer. It was a internal thing. I forget what it was. It may be pancreatic cancer, but he left behind
one-itis.
He left behind this amazing sort of legacy. One of the things that Lovecraft did
it was cancer of the small intestine.
Intestine. Yes,
he was diagnosed in 1937. No, yes. You were close.
All of you Lovecraftians, please take your hands off the keyboard. The reason why he is discussed and remembered is because with the Call of Cthulhu, he started one of the first shared worlds. He would allow his literary friends and correspondents to drop references in their stories from his work. And he did it with them as well. Yeah. And over time, this process of sort of name-checking blasphemous tomes and eldritch creatures became the writers that did this became known as sort of the Lovecraft Circle. And anytime anybody would write Lovecraft and say, hey, where can I buy a copy of the Necronomicon? He'd go, I made it up. I made it up. It's a joke. But hey, why don't you put it in your story? And we'll kind of make a thing out of it. That's really what's significant, is because of the number of writers that were in this circle, which included Robert Bloch, who would later go on to write Psycho, Frank Belknap Long, Clark Atchison Smith, Robert E. Howard. Lovecraft was an influence during his time. And afterwards, his fans and fellow writers sort of decided to keep the flame going. And that led to the formation of Arkham House and the successive publication of his stories, which continues even to this day. Was that short enough?
Nice.
That was good.
You mentioned Arkham House. Again, that's a reference to Arkham, Massachusetts, where a lot of his stories take place, in this fictional town of Arkham, Massachusetts.
That's right.
Arkham Asylum, for you DC Comics lovers out there, was obviously a nod to Arkham, Massachusetts, the H.P. Lovecraft, the creepy H.P. Lovecraft town where weird things go on.
And do you know why that is?
I do not.
It is because Julie Schwartz, the editor at DC Comics at the time and on the Batman titles, was briefly Lovecraft's agent. He was
really
Lovecraft's
agent. How about that? Isn't that a weird connection?
You know why Lovecraft I knew that? Why? Because Mark mentioned it several podcasts ago, and I'm the editor.
Oh,
all right. Well, no, that's awesome.
Hey,
that's
the accidental editor. Come on.
and to be clear, one of the people on it was on a Facebook post. One of the people pointed out that, oh well, you know, there's what people are calling Lovecraftian now existed before Lovecraft, and that is true. It did. Lovecraft himself had his influences. He was influenced by Edgar Allan Poe, very clearly influenced by Edgar Allan Poe. He was influenced by Arthur Machen. He was influenced by Algernon Blackwood. I mean, people were writing stories that had that sort of vibe that Lovecraft later would sort of become the master of in them. One of my favorite stories by Arthur Machen is The Great God Pan. And if you read The Great God Pan, and I recommend everybody do it, it's online, it's free, it's a short story. You will see, if you are a Lovecraft fan, you will see the influences into Lovecraft's work. And it's there. If you read The King in Yellow, if you read Blackwood's Wendigo. I mean, so what Lovecraft did, as Mark pointed out early on, is that he took all that stuff, which is already floating in the ether. Authors have been playing with this sort of thing for a long time. And then he just created his own unique universe. He codified it.
He put it together.
He did what Tolkien did for fantasy geeks, created his own world, filled it with all this stuff. He was also influenced by many, many things, Tolkien was. And that's what Lovecraft did. Lovecraft created Cthulhu. He created Nyarlathotep. He created all these the mythos creatures, but all very much influenced by works that had gone before.
Now, some of them were created by other people in response to Lovecraft, like Nyarlathotep is apparently copyright August Derleth. So,
right. Well, no, it was Derleth may hold the copyright, but I think it was Block who did most of the Nyarlathotep work. Clark Ashton Smith and Robert E. Howard were the guys that were the closest to Lovecraft in this regard. Even though other people did other mythos things, Lovecraft's kind of right and left-hand man, Clark Ashton Smith and Howard, were the two biggest, or I guess most influential signifiers. And that Lovecraft would then take those things and put them in his, it kind of muddied the waters, and Lovecraft was okay with that. He liked the fact that it was kind of this messy sort of loosey-goosey affiliation. So,
yeah, because then it's literally a mythos.
You described, and you meant Aaron mentioned it as I knew he would, Robert Chambers' collection of stories, The King in Yellow. Yes. And I want to briefly touch on that for two reasons. One, my beautiful wife surprised me with a gift that was one of those mysterious package gifts where things arrived in the mail and I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Isn't that cool?
Yes. And what she got me was this King in Yellow themed story that a letter arrived that was postmarked, in the 70s.
You got
70s.
One of those.
Yeah, that looked like it had been sent, but then somehow forwarded and then stepped on a million times and arrived at my door somehow telling me this clipping was important and hang on to it. But it just builds up to this, there's reports of this mysterious play that's opening and this reporter's going to go check it out because no one's talking about it. And when the play does play at midnight in the middle of nowhere, these people in evening gowns and tuxedos go into this play. And the reporter can't get in, but then the doors fly open and everyone comes running out and they're completely mad. Clothes are flying off and they're screaming. They're scratching each other and they're running off screaming into the night. What the hell? And he goes in and it's brilliant. He finds all these candles and these weird stuff and he finds these little statues, these tiny creepy statues. The final package was a box, an old wooden box that was nailed shut. And I opened it up and one of those damn statues was in it, which is creepy as hell. Very well done.
Nice.
And I still have that sucker and it's in a box. It's not displayed because it just gives me the heebie-jeebies. But that's the kind of thing that I wanted to point to because it's what you don't see in some of these Lovecraft stories that strike me as horrific. The descriptive, sometimes it's like it cannot be described.
Yeah, Joseph, not to cut you off here, but we really should work. We should stay what we think our working definition of Lovecraftian is. And I think you're on it right there because I think a lot of people are defining it differently.
Yes.
Well, the idea that it's there's an H.P. Lovecraft short story called The Unnameable, which they made the movie, two of them actually, out of, where this thing in this old house in Arkham is so hideous, so horrific, so disfigured and deformed, so unhuman that it cannot be described. It is unnameable. And what I love about Lovecraft and some of the things that he does and some of the ancient ones that he describes in this mythos, they're boggle the mind. They will make you mad just to behold them because mm-hmm. it doesn't factor into reality. Yet there it is, gibbering and slippering and tentacling its way across the floor towards you. And all you could do is scream, or not even scream. You're too terrified. You're mad. You know, yeah. That level of horror that gut punches you. And you're
the architecture is non-Euclidean. And
it's stunned. You're stunned, right? Yep. And I love that. I love the idea that, and it's better than any description. It's better than anything that anyone could write about the monster that you see. To describe it as unnameable and madness-inducing is good enough.
Yeah.
And by the way, that is when I talk about the influences with Mackin and Blackwood and such, that's what they excelled at. They excelled at giving you just a hint of what lived in the darkness. Yeah. They didn't tell you like, oh, it had a goat's head and wings and no. it's movement. It's a sensation. It's a sound. It's shift. It's something that shifts in the shadows, you know. Yeah. And that is what terrifies people the most. When you wake up in the middle of the night and you see this dark shape on the floor and you do not know what it is and you don't remember that shape being there when you went to bed, that is terrifying more than if you woke up and it's like, oh, look, somebody, you know, Elena forgot one of her toys or whatever. You know, once you see it, even if it's kind of creepy, that's like, oh, what is that? You know, your rational mind kicks in.
Yeah. I think that is where
Lovecraft lives. He lives in the unconscious. He lives in that thought just beyond the rational mind.
Lovecraft was actually really actively studying the effects of terror and horror, and he wrote an essay, Supernatural Horror and Literature, which is sort of his working thesis of how things are scary. It ends up being kind of a Bible for what would become known as the weird tale. And he name checks and mentions a lot of his influences, including some of the current people who are doing things and like Smith and Howard. And so for those of you that are interested, it's in the public domain. It's very easy to find. Supernatural Horror and Literature by H.P. Lovecraft. It's a lengthy piece, but if you're interested in these proto-influences of Lovecraft, you can certainly go and check that out. Yeah. But and Joseph, I'm glad that you mentioned The Unnameable, and Aaron, I'm glad you followed up on that, because for us, and if you ever hear us, you know, mention Lovecraftian, what a lot of people tend to think that is tentacles.
Yeah.
Tentacles.
You know, yeah, it's true. It's true.
Or more disingenuously, tentacle porn. You know?
Hentai,
as the kids like to call it these days with their jazz records and their roller skates. But anyways, let me assure you that the part of the pop culturization of Lovecraft's work, which has essentially been played out in the cartooning of Cthulhu and the redrawing of Cthulhu and the appropriation of Cthulhu and this sort of reductiveness that takes place. There's always a reduction, a distillation for pop culture. And it boils down to, oh, well, if it's got tentacles, it's Lovecraftian.
Right.
And I think that's really unfair. And I think that does Lovecraft's work a disservice, because I think the best things, I think sometimes the tentacles can be a signifier, such as in the film Hellboy, whereby we see Rasputin trying to break through the wall of reality as we understand it and summon these elder gods from the darkest reaches of space beyond Pluto, and we see these cephalopod like things shifting in jeweled prisons, you know, and there's this lurching, you can see the tentacles kind of shifting as they anticipate, you know, their release into this world, you know, and certainly that's that. But there's a lot, there's more going on top of that make that a Lovecraftian thing rather than just, oh, there's tentacles.
So yeah, because a lot of people think like The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing, is Lovecraftian, mm-hmm. and while it has certain elements to it, it's directly based off of a John Campbell story.
It's mm-hmm. right.
Called it is, there, but and yeah, it's the ultimate tentacles, you know.
But absolutely. But I think actually that is Lovecraftian, not for the, believe it or not, shape-shifting tentacled creature. I think that is Lovecraftian for its theme of just nihilism and the hopelessness, the right? Yeah. This thing came from out there, and we have no chance to stop it, and it's going to eventually win, and all you can do is try your best to battle it, but you're going to fail.
I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you said battle it, because I wanted to point to one thing that I love about Lovecraft stories is that he does have recurring characters, and there is a hero that H.P. Lovecraft created who was sort of representative of himself. He was a writer. He was an intellect. wasn't a thug. Wasn't a brawny dude. But he would be able to fight back some of these creatures and not go mad when he faced them. And that was our friend Randolph Carter. Randolph yep. Carter was the recurring hero in some of Lovecraft's stories. And no I love the idea. No relation to John. But I love the idea that someone, and it's usually a guy with a book in his hand, not a gun, can figure this out.
Yeah.
And somehow end the threat and close the gate, or at least hold them back for a couple of millennia more, or maybe 20 years more, whatever it takes.
Librarian as a hero.
You know? Yeah, well, and that's important. That's an important type, you know?
My favorite of his guys is Henry Armitage from the Dunwich Horror, because he's the one who knows what's in the books and is trying to kind of keep people away from him. And then when the Dunwich Horror breaks free, you know, he's the one that has to that chases it through the countryside. And again, you know, the people that are encountering it, you know, they've got guns because they're on farms, and you know, it's just laying waste. He's the one that goes after it with a book. You know, it was fun.
Right. Yeah. And that's a great archetype that I think can be credited to a lot of those types of stories where we have someone, you know, obviously very, very intelligent, who is, you know, either writing a case or writing his report or sharing with you in his journal about what happens. And it's that point of view of him describing the actions and what's going on that pulls you into that story. And I think Lovecraft was masterful at it.
I think it kind of reflects almost his life. I mean, it's a reflection of himself. Howard, who was much more physical and loved boxing and you know, could be seen walking through the streets, you know, practicing his boxing moves. I mean, he created this muscle-bound, you know, tough as nails character Conan. That was his protagonist. Poor Lovecraft, who spent a sickly boy, spent his whole life pretty much, you know, indoors, had a variety of different physical issues. All he could have as a hero is the guy who was like him, who had the knowledge and read the books and knew all about the secret mysteries and how to unravel them. And so his protagonist naturally was that type of person.
There is a bit of a myth here I will shatter. Lovecraft wasn't sickly as an adult. He actually did a lot of traveling through his native state, and actually lived in New York briefly when he was married to Sonya Green.
Right.
But I think part of where that kind of idea comes from is that he sort of played up his elder statesman status to a lot of his correspondents. And we have enough of his letters to know that he would essentially sort of adopt a pose that was that the correspondent needed. And so there's a lot of kind of not everybody sees Lovecraft the same way, because he didn't present himself the same way to people through the letters. But your point is,
he did grow up. He grew up with, he would have night terrors. He was sickly. He had a nervous breakdown.
I forget what he had as a kid that kind of kept him in for a while. I want to say it was
mother is what I thought. He was very influenced by his mother, and his mother had a big hold on him. At least he lived with her for quite a while, and then after she died, his health deteriorated. Am I remembering that incorrectly?
Some of that's conflated with Howard.
Oh, I see.
Howard. Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
And
okay.
So, but he was the it takes nothing away from your point, is that he viewed himself as an intellectual creature, a creature of intellect.
Right.
And this really comes out more stridently anywhere else in the letters between Howard and Lovecraft. They get into a debate that is kind of referred to as barbarism versus civilization. Howard mentions, you know, how, you know, in a past life, he imagined that he would be the Pict on the outside of the Roman walls, trying to break the door in and tear down the civilization. And Lovecraft says, "Oh, I much more sympathize with the Roman on the wall." And this started a conversation that literally became an argument that ran through their letters for 3.5 years, back and forth, them debating the merits of what Howard called barbarism, but what he really meant was sort of a natural tribalism, and and Lovecraft vitriolically defending law, order, civilization, progress, and so that's part of his mystique. It's part of what he built up, you know. But he did go to, you know, and Arkham is fictitious, as you said, as so is Innsmouth and Kingsport, and he basically. Miskatonic University. He made all that stuff up, but it's all based on his part of the world. And so he traveled in there, and he went to these small towns, and he would travel by bus, and he would see these people. And I think part of Lovecraft's personal, let's call them prejudices, you know, factors into this. You know, there's a real fear of the unknown, and the unknown in Lovecraft stories takes shape in different ways. Sometimes it's the unknown of space and time and what's really out there, and this notion that not only are we sort of alone in the universe, but we're the smallest part of it. We're the most insignificant part of it.
Both his parents, both his mother and father, essentially died in sanitariums. I mean,
yeah,
did they?
His father went insane. His father actually was committed to an asylum where he died. It was thought to be of syphilis, but neither Lovecraft nor the mother had any sign of that, so they're not sure about that. And then the mother later on suffering what was deemed to be hysteria and depression for a long period of time was committed to Butler Hospital, a mental institution, exactly where her husband had died. Yeah. And, you know, eventually she died of gallbladder surgery, but same thing. I mean, he grew up seeing the people he cared about and loved most going insane around him, you know? So again, it's almost like his life is like one of his stories.
I'd like to point to this own, not to be lascivious in any way, but I think it's fascinating that people have been studying Lovecraft and his inspirations and his points of view, you know, for years. You read all kinds of stuff. And I remember a very interesting thing that I had read that somebody was surmising, because Lovecraft was, shall we say, he avoided sexual talk. He had an aversion to sexuality in talking about sexuality.
Puritanical streak, yes.
A bit. But there was more than that. It was much more of a mental block he had about even the female genitalia. He couldn't even look at it. He had an aversion to it, which a lot of people were theorizing that his old ones, and Cthulhu himself, who, if you look at his face, has a resemblance to sort of, you know, female genitalia, that Lovecraft himself felt that was the enemy, that was the unknown, that was... And he knew, because it was so prominent everywhere he went and all around him, that he was the sole guy.
He was married. He was married for many years.
That means nothing. Being married for many, many years means
nothing.
No, I know.
But I'm saying it's not, he wasn't like this sort of little virginal mama's boy that lived
But I mean, there was something about him mentally that couldn't quite comprehend or couldn't understand or appreciate that. And again, I'm only mentioning it because I find it interesting to make the character of Lovecraft kind of fleshed out for us. This nebbish, almost sickly, that, you know, we walking around with books and I'm married, but I have to turn the lights off and I can't, you know, look at it. And, you know, he's that kind of a guy, right?
There was definitely a puritanical streak.
This could all be blown way out of proportion, because all we have to go on, really, because he did not die a success. He didn't die heralded as a master writer. He died fairly poor. You know, even though he influenced people in his own lifetime, he died relatively poor.
Both he and Howard got, they were lauded in the pages of Weird Tales magazine and celebrated, you know, with their and mourned in their passing. But outside of, but Weird Tales magazine was one magazine out of, you know, 100. And so, yeah, they were destined to sort of die in obscurity had it not been for the fans who sort of took the love of the pulps forward into the 50s. So, yeah, it was kind of messed up.
So let's talk about Lovecraft as he is now exposed to the public. Aaron made a statement that he feels that Lovecraftian entertainment is now making a comeback, or it's now at a peak, or it's coming back. And while that is true, I see a lot of it with Stranger Things and things of that ilk. I want to go back in time and talk about some of the original adaptations of some of Lovecraft's works.
Yes.
One of my favorite is from the original Edgar Allan Poe run of AIP, with Vincent Price playing all kinds of different Poe characters. Well, they ran out of Poe stories, and Sam Arkoff and James Nicholson were like, well, you need more of those Poe stories. So here's a story. It's called the Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Well, make that one and give it a Poe name. Call it The Haunted Palace. But it has nothing to do with it. Just call it The Haunted Palace. Okay. So The Haunted Palace is really The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, which is an H.P. Lovecraft story.
Which keeps getting remade.
Yeah.
And H.P. Lovecraft, Vincent Price plays Joseph Curwen, the ancient warlock who was reincarnated in the body of his ancestor, Charles Dexter Ward. And it's very well done. Again, it's a little simplistic. It's in the 60s, so it's not, you know, technically as advanced. That film was made again as The Resurrected with Chris Sarandon. And that film, I think it was from the 80s, that film has a great sequence in the basement of the house where there are these description little things in these pits.
Yes.
And we hear them, and one of the characters gets sucked down into it, and you hear him screaming, but we don't see what's in the pits, and I love that.
That is one of the, in my opinion, one of the most Lovecraftian scenes ever put into a movie is you hear them, they're down there, they're in the dark. In fact, I remember even the actors themselves. I mean, it's not like it's fake dark. No, they're stumbling around with these tiny little lighters or whatever. You barely see their faces. They're wandering in a sea of black. It's incredibly creepy and scary.
And of all the low budget, semi-cheesy Lovecraftian adaptations, not the higher budget ones with the great effects things, that's my favorite one for tone and just barely being good enough to not make you laugh at it.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's well done.
It's directed by Dan O'Bannon, the guy who wrote Alien.
Yes, that's correct. I'd forgotten that. No, it's I'm a big fan of that film. I'm a big
fan. And directed Return of the Living Dead as well.
Oh, I forgot that. Yes, he did.
Yeah, HP was also brought to the screens in a Boris Karloff flick called Die, Monster, Die.
Yes. Which
was The Color Out of Space. It was Lovecraft's The Color Out of Space. And it's, you know, Boris Karloff in that film. The Dunwich Horror was with, help me out, who was in that? That was
Dean Stockwell.
Dean Stockwell was the first one.
Sandra Dee.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're, you know, and so they're Lovecraft's
and then done again with
out.
Jeffrey Combs, actually, for sci-fi.
I love Jeffrey Combs.
Yeah,
well, Jeffrey Combs, if there was an actor, if Roddy McDowall was the actor best known for the apes, he represents everything about Planet of the Apes, Jeffrey Combs is an H.P. Lovecraft actor. You can look at him and go, well, as Herbert West, Reanimator, and there's, you know...
In the 80s is when we got the Reanimator. It was an 84 movie. And then Brian Yuzna was the guy that was producing those, and they followed it up with... From Beyond, and it was. I know. Well, I'm going to give you your chance, Mickey, because what's interesting about the '80s take on Lovecraft is that it was weird that they chose stories that were kind of slight and not necessarily connected to the mythos stories per se, but they actually did the opposite of Lovecraft. They instead of not having any explicit gore and sexuality, they put it all in there, and I found that to be very interesting because it fragmented the base. Now these things are considered sort of weird little classics. Of the two, I actually thought that From Beyond was the more successful attempt. Mickey, you have a different opinion about From Beyond. I want to hear about this.
Well, okay, one thing you have to understand is that I come at all this. I've never actually read that much Lovecraft. I'm not into his actual stories because it's just not for me. I prefer the more modern takes like Titus Crowe and a uh-huh. lot of the adaptations and stuff like that. So for me, I didn't remember From Beyond. I saw it back in the 90s. I didn't remember it today since we were going to be doing Lovecraft. I went, that's the one Lovecraftian movie I've seen that I don't remember. Let's rewatch it. And oh God, I want my life back. It is so poorly made as a movie. It's 5 minutes worth of materials. It might be the best adaptation of the of between that and Reanimator, but it's like it's not even the same director. While Reanimator didn't move fast, it at least moved. This kind of shambles all over the place like a shambling horror.
I have great affection for those. I mean, that was Stuart Gordon doing the slasher version, the splatterpunk version of Lovecraft. It's very much a product of its time. I think during that time, a lot of movies were coming out that were gore-filled. And I mean, but that's why I'm fond of them. I'm fond of that complete over-the-top, ridiculous, now what we consider Sam Raimi-esque horror.
The thing. Sam Raimi goes over the top and knows how to build it up and everything like that. From Beyond, you're watching it for a half an hour. Nothing's really happening. Oh, God, do we... Oh, look, let's get a little over-intense with the psychosexual side of things. Okay, now we're back to just randomly wandering around the corridors like a bad Doctor Who episode.
I don't know, man. Kinfori's in it, and he's great. It's an understated performance from Jeffrey Combs. It's not as over the top and kind of black humor is in fact there's not any black humor in it. Reanimator had a dark streak to it From Beyond was trying to play it straight. Well, I think what I liked about it was that they didn't shy from the things on the other side of the veil that we're just now seeing, and even though they weren't necessarily handled in a sophisticated manner, they did the best they could with the budget that they had. And at the end, somebody goes mad, which I thought was kind of cool because, I mean, really.
Somebody's always going mad.
Barbara Crampton's laugh in that is genuinely unsettling at the end. She has seen, she basically is the one who has seen too much.
Yeah. And I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
Like the policeman has a creepy laugh. And he turns out to be the most pure of any of them, but he's got a creepy laugh and makes you think that he's going to be like go horribly wrong later by the end of the episode or by the end of the movie.
Mickey, on your head, what is it? That is something I'm sorry, that's your pineal gland. My bad.
it seems to be sticking out, man. You ought to put a Band-Aid on that. That's weird.
Yeah, I am fond of those stories. But again, I came to it in the reverse order, right? Like Mickey, I had not read a lot of the stories. I have now. But I grew up in the 80s watching Reanimator and From Beyond and these kind of movies. And so I became aware of the name H.P. Lovecraft through Stuart Gordon's work. So I'll always be grateful for that. And then, of course, I was like, who's this Lovecraft guy? And then I started looking into it and started reading the original Mytho stories. And I love that they're like that. You can take almost like a decade, and you can take the Lovecraft movies from that decade, and Joseph already covered some really wonderful ones in the early Vincent Price and Boris Karloff. They were of a certain style and of a certain feel for that generation. Then we have the Stuart Gordon stuff from primarily the 80s. Going into that, further, one of my favorite ones that I've recently seen, not even a big budget one, not something that came out of Hollywood, it's a German movie. And it's The Color Out of Space, called Die Farbe. And it is wonderful. I recommend everybody try to find where this is showing. I think you can rent it on Amazon. I don't want to say for sure, but I think that's where I saw it.
Yeah.
And it is a black and white German adaptation of The Color Out of Space. And it is just, the pacing may not be for everybody. It is slow. And there's a lot of voiceover narration. But it's done. I think it's done so well. And the one beautiful thing they decided to do is everything is in black and white except the actual color out of space, which is a sickly purple violet. And every time that starts infecting somewhere, it'll be a black and white scene, and the characters will come running in, and you can see the purple light shining on them. And when they look, you see in this black and white scene this sickly purple light infecting everything. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Defarb, I recommend everybody see it. And there's also, of course, there's a much even lower budget than that one made called Cthulhu that was made, a black and white, that almost like a silent film, not like a silent film, which people are very fond of.
Basically crowdfunded, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And but again, for what it was, and I love that fans, I mean, if you ever do a search on YouTube and you do Lovecraft fan films, whoa, you have viewing for 2-3 hours at least.
Yeah, buckle up.
Everybody has done, and it's great. It's like you get these young filmmakers that go to these well-known film schools, and they're looking for material to do for their first short film or whatnot, and almost invariably they reach out to one of the Lovecraft stories, whatever it is. And some of them are really, really bad, and some of them are actually quite well done. There's one that has, and I don't remember the actor's name. He is the perfect, in my opinion, he is the perfect character to play, H.P. Lovecraft. He looks like him. He played a villain on Hell on Wheels.
Haven't seen Hell on Wheels, but are you talking about Julian Richling?
I don't know.
He does look a lot like Lovecraft though, and he's in a lot of things.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Well, while Aaron's doing that,
Christopher
Heyerdahl. Oh, right. Yeah.
And he looks like Lovecraft. Oh my God, let me tell you, he looks like Lovecraft.
Well, in the theming of these films in TV, whenever we talk about Lovecraft-inspired films and television, I personally enjoy the standalone dark graveyard horrors that Lovecraft cooks up with the ghouls and the reanimated dead and the hounds that chase you if you dig into graves and crap of that sort. I like that better than his mythology and his Cthulhu mythos and his, you know, that the ancient one stuff. I wanted to mention a film that I thought was a Lovecraft, but I was mistaken. It is not Lovecraft, but I'd be damned if it wasn't influenced by Lovecraft. And that was another Vincent Price film called War Gods of the Deep.
Oh, right.
Also known,
it kind of sounds like a Lovecraft.
It was also inspired by Poe's poem, The City Beneath the Sea, when Vincent Price plays this captain who went down with his ship and he lives underwater in this sea, and he sends these weird mermen up to take women and bring them back down. And the opening of it, when there's this house on the cliff in the water, and in the middle of the night, something slimy and gross and amphibian crawls into the house from the sea, it's very Lovecraftian. But it's not. But these are the types of films and styles and points of view that one can point at and go, you know what? That's very Lovecraftian. That feels Lovecraftian.
It has that Shadow over Innsmouth kind of feel to it. Yeah.
A remake of the Color Out of Space was The Curse from the 80s, 87, I think. The Curse.
With Will Wheaton.
Which was very creepy, and I thought very well done. But I liked those standalones better. I have not yet seen a Cthulhu movie of the Cthulhu mythos that I thought was satisfactory.
So if you guys know one,
yes. Point one out.
Literally from Lovecraft as opposed to a tribute to Lovecraft.
Exactly.
Because Carpenter has a fantastic Lovecraftian movie.
He's talking about The Mouth of Madness.
Mouth of Madness is fantastic.
I think Prince of Darkness kind of falls in that rubric as well.
Yeah.
Have you seen any of the things that the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society has put together, Joseph?
Are these films that had theatrical release or video release or?
There's two available right now. There is The Call of Cthulhu, and it is done in the mode of a silent movie from the 1920s.
Yeah, we just talked about that. That was the movie that was done. Yeah, uh huh. By the way, D. Farb. See D. Farb, Joseph. If you want to see one of the best adaptations, the actual adaptation of a Lovecraft story, see the German film D. Farb. It's very well done.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I'm gonna also recommend The Whisper in Darkness. From the same people, they're attempting to sort of recreate the material and they're recreating the style of the filmmaking as well.
And these are independent films that have been created by this.
Yeah, they're both available on DVD. They're easy to get. I recommend those. Those are really great adaptations. They work better than they don't. And first of all, these guys are doing it for the love, you know. And as good as Whisper in Darkness is, as good as it is, in the end, they had to do. Now, these are fans. These are dyed in the wool, hardcore. These are the guys. In the end, they had to change the ending, and add some things into the ending to satisfy the needs of the medium that they were adapting for. Now it's not a bad thing. It simply is what it is. Your mileage will vary. But both of these movies do something that I don't think any of the other films have been able to do, which is get first generation Lovecraft into a movie format. And the reason is because it's like you said earlier, the unknown, the unknowable, the indescribable is very difficult to portray in a medium that relies on sight and sound. And so I think Lovecraft works best as an influence rather than a primary source.
I mean, like we talked about also, the way they did it in The Resurrected, I mean, well, you didn't see it, but it was still terrifying. You know, there was something there that you didn't see.
There's another Brian Usna film, a series of short stories called H.P. Lovecraft's Necronomicon.
Oh, sure.
Yes. Yeah, I remember that.
And that also has Jeffrey Combs, David Warner.
I saw those.
A few other people. But again, I mean, that's they are a series affiliated H.P. Lovecraft stories, where it basically follows a man who wants to go get the Necronomicon. And these are stories that are told while I believe he's reading the Necronomicon.
Yeah.
And so, but that's well done.
It's actually Lovecraft.
It is, isn't it? It is Lovecraft.
Yeah. Jeffrey Combs plays Lovecraft.
Yes.
And he's in prosthetic makeup to sort of sell the look.
I want to point to one thing before we start to wrap up here, because something that I thought was interesting was there's a lot of people, and this is, I'm serious here, folks. There's a lot of people who say that Lovecraft claiming that all this was made up was Lovecraft trying to protect and hide something. That Lovecraft actually tapped into something very real. Now, I'm not going to go out there and say that the ancient ones are out there and Cthulhu sleeps quietly in the middle of the ocean waiting to wake up and kill us all. But these people, and I'm dead serious, do some research and look this up. They were like, no. H.P. Lovecraft claimed he wrote the Necronomicon? No, he didn't. No, it was the Mad Arab. He wrote it. And Lovecraft read it, and Lovecraft went mad. And Lovecraft decided to deal with this madness by writing these stories. But in the end, he said, no, I made it all up. I swear, I made it all up. But the truth of it was, folks,
I haunt YouTube all the time. I don't know why. I guess I'm bored. YouTube has videos that are made by self-proclaimed high priests of the Necronomicon. And they're serious. They are deadly serious.
Yeah.
And they believe it like it's a real text. They study it like Christians study the Bible. Oh. They cast spells from it and the whole nine yards. And they are serious, as serious, I suppose, as someone can be. But here's my opinion of ultimately why Lovecraft stories resonate the way they do, impact us, no matter where we're from, what culture we're from. The primal horrors that he is talking about, I think those are real. We are a tiny, tiny, infinitesimally small speck in a vast, vast cosmic ocean. And there is no telling what sort of life or creatures or beings exist in other worlds, in other parts of space, whether we can even call them living creatures? Are they like us? Are they carbon based? I mean, we have no clue what is out there, but I do believe that the ultimate take of Lovecraft stories is, I don't believe that these things are benevolent. I don't believe they mean us no harm. I don't believe that if we ever encountered them, they would sit down and have a pleasant conversation with us and want to share technology. I believe they would be utterly alien, and we would be probably nothing but food or worse to them. And I think at some part of our lizard brain, most people feel that way. The fear of the other. We've been afraid of the dark since we crawled out of caves. What is out there in the darkness? I don't know. But my instincts tell me, don't go out there. Stay here in the cave, right by the fire, with those that you know and love and understand, and you will hear the cries and the howls and the ululations and the yammerings of the things out there that probably just want to eat you. So that I think is what he plugs into, and that is why people, no matter who you are, go, yeah, I'm afraid of those things. And with good reason.
So what you were saying is Carl Sagan is the polar opposite of H.P. Lovecraft.
Basically.
Just a quick note, Aaron's available for children's parties.
Yeah.
If any of you are wanting to try something a little, if you want to, you know, forego the clown balloon animal route, he's great.
He's better
with
the
than
kids. The Patton Oswalt clown story.
I do a great Cthulhu balloon animal, let me just tell you.
Oh, Lord.
Look, come on. Well, guys, really? I mean, are you not with me on this?
Well,
the vast ocean that we exist, we think life out there is going to be like, aliens?
I'm not saying that I totally subscribe to your interpretation of things, but I will say that having read Lovecraft mostly during my teenage years, the notion that I was not the center of the universe, and in fact I was at its farthest edge, and it was and I was nothing but a speck of dust in the wake of these indifferent cosmic beings, was pretty much the most terrifying thing that a 16-year-old can come up with. Yeah. Now, having said all of that, I think going forward, for all of the negatives that Lovecraft brings to the table, I think we should at least talk very quickly, give maybe a recommendation as evidence of like this being a valid means of storytelling. Or, you know, what's your favorite iteration of Lovecraftian? I have a thought on that, but I'd like to hear what you guys think.
I'll dive in. We talked about in entertainment, movie, TV, whatever. Okay, yeah,
movie, TV, whatever. Sure.
While Lovecraft himself called the little series he wrote trash, and was paid only $5 for each short story he submitted, I have to go with Herbert West Reanimator.
Yeah.
I love the idea. And by the way, that story, that Herbert West story, was the very first time Miskatonic University was ever put out there. He created Miskatonic for this short story. And the film, of course, many people have already seen this film. It's so over the top, and it's so gleeful in its depiction. But it's Jeffrey Combs who holds it together like glue. When you have the character of his assistant, Dan, Dr. Kane, who's assisting him, and we can almost picture him being, and in the stories he was, the person who's writing all this down, who's saying that I met Herbert West one day and he did this, and then we did this, and it was crazy, but we did this too, and oh my God, I thought he was dead, but he came back, here he was again. You could almost hear him narrating it. I kind of wish he would have. I kind of wish they would have had his narration, or at least, you know, begun it with him in an asylum and talking about Herbert West, and then we flashback. But anyway, I still love that film, and the short stories are very much in tune with the films, with them dragging a corpse of a construction worker who died into an old barn in the middle of the dark, dark night and injecting West serum into it. And then you just hear this horrible scream, and West and Kane run out because they're like, they freak out and they run away, and a lantern turns over, the thing burns up, and then they come back the next day, and that the barn is completely obliterated, scorched earth. And then they go back to the grave where they dug him up, and it's all covered up, and there's claw marks on the grave, like it put itself back into the ground. I love that kind of stuff. And while, again, the movie obviously hit on a different level, I think it's Lovecraftian enough to take that. It's a standalone, nothing about Cthulhu.
as a standalone, I think it's worthwhile. I think it's absolutely a gem in the H.P. Lovecraft crown.
Very good.
Nice.
That's mine. Nice. That's mine.
Mickey?
We've already mentioned At the Mouth of Madness and some of the other things out there that are great. So I'm going to go the complete opposite direction. Mm-hmm. And there's a movie that you can now find on Amazon. It used to be an HBO film. It was one of the original HBO films.
Oh, no. You're going to talk about Cast a Deadly Spell, aren't you?
Cast a Deadly Spell.
Oh, Mickey, come on, man. That's not Lovecraftian. Oh, Jesus.
Phil Lovecraft is a private investigator. Ray Bradbury is a police detective. It is mostly tongue-in-cheek spin on all this. And while it's not a great representation of Lovecraft itself, despite it having the Necronomicon and everything else in it, we've already talked about all the things that I would normally talk about here. So an honorable mention goes out to that. And it's also a lot of the urban fantasy stuff that's out there. It's considered one of the inspirations for a lot of those authors.
And that's true. Don't they actually, I saw that movie years ago, but don't they actually show Cthulhu in that at the end? Doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's not Cthulhu. It's, I don't know the mythos well enough. Claudia would know this. It's one of his minions. That's like the gatekeeper.
I believe it's like Shub-Niggurath or something like that. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Shut your mouth.
I'm just talking about.
And it also does the, it also does the, wait, I thought you said you were a virgin routine.
Oh yeah. That's right.
Monster Squad.
And it's almost like a hair. If I remember correctly, it's in a universe where everyone uses magic except for
Lovecraft. Yes.
Yeah. He doesn't. He refuses.
Lovecraft
to use
does
magic.
Not trust magic.
Right. Right. Interesting. All right, Mark. Come on.
No, it's all right. Go ahead. Well, I'm not a fan. I thought it was wankery when I saw it, and my opinion of that has not changed over time.
Dear God, don't see the sequel.
No danger of that.
The sequel I would rather gouge out
my own eyes with a toothpick.
Yeah. Ooh, Witch Hunt is horrible. Part of what makes if you like Cast a Deadly Spell, part of what makes it work is the charm of the actors. We've got Fred Ward playing Lovecraft.
Witch Hunt with Dennis Hopper? That's what I'm saying. So Fred Ward is not in Witch Hunt?
No. Dennis Hopper's playing the character in Witch Hunt.
Oh, no.
Yes.
That's just even worse.
It has no charm whatsoever, and it's like, what's the point of this existing?
Boy, oh boy.
Put it on the radio.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the second one is the first one's a lot of fun, but the second one didn't appeal to me.
Oh, and we should also mention, since it's out relatively recently, The Void, which I thought had a great first half and a messy second half.
Yes. Now here's strange enough. Here's the thing. I'm going to recommend a bunch of movies that are not Lovecraft stories, but that capture that. Several. There's one called Abstentia. That is very, very much, I think, a Lovecraftian story about a woman trying to figure out the disappearance of her husband. All of these will have in common the element that I just waxed on about with Why We're Afraid. I would say the original Alien mm-hmm. has an amazingly awesome Lovecraftian feel to it. Something from out there that should never have been disturbed is, and now we see that it is completely foreign and alien and wants nothing more than to devour us. I think
before Prometheus came along, that the owners of the ship were these huge giant godlike creatures that were killed by something.
Exactly. No, I think that is DeFarb, I've already talked about, which I think is fantastic. Another little gem, found footage, which I'm not usually a big fan of, but the Europa Report.
Yes.
Astronauts going and landing on Europa. And again, goes back to that thing I was talking about. Oh, look, is there life on Europa? Will it be beautiful? Will it be a blossoming little flower? No, it's a horrific squid-like thing under the ice that's going to destroy you.
Spoilers.
That's what's out there. Event Horizon has that same feel. Let's go explore space, folks.
I so want Event Horizon to have had its director's cut, because there's like 20 or 30 minutes missing from there that would have gone from, hey, we've got a great start, to we've got a gonzo finish. What the hell happened in between?
Yeah. And by the way, none of these movies are by any means what I would consider perfect or amazing, well, with the exception of Alien. But they capture that feeling of, oh my God, don't go out there. Don't when you are on the Serengeti, you don't stand up and start screaming at the top of your lungs because something will come find you and you're not going to like it. Don't
do it.
Your
report's pretty tight.
Yeah, your Europa report I think is fantastic.
Aaron, your description has triggered something in me, and I'm going to just toss this out there as a Lovecraftian film that I never thought of as a Lovecraftian film until your description.
Okay.
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
I would say that has Lovecraftian elements, yes.
They go to a forbidden black lagoon that hasn't been touched in millions of years,
yep.
And there's this Devonian throwback that's living out there that's a fish man thing that apparently wants to mate with Julie Adams.
That miscegenation vibe and the throwback to another evolutionary offshoot.
Yeah, the deep one.
It's certainly proto Lovecraft, if not Lovecraftian. I mean,
It is literally finding something that predates man and is in when you realize it is so much more powerful than man and could apparently just cause all of our destruction. Yeah. And it's men that went and started messing with it. They should have left it alone.
Fair enough.
Sleeping, but nope, mm-hmm. nope. We woke it up. Hey, what you doing? What you doing?
Poke it.
Yeah.
The X-Files season one episode Ice falls underneath that too. And it's just a microbe. Mark? Or it's not a microbe, it's a worm.
I'll close our list with something recent that was lauded for its brilliant repurposing of Lovecraftian tropes, and that's True Detective.
Yes.
The series from HBO, which evokes and uses Robert Chambers' The Yellow Sign and The King in Yellow as a signifier for the bad guys. And I'll tell you what makes this work. There's something wonderful. I have a love of police procedurals and things like that. And people in jobs like policemen and firemen, when they retire, if it's not old age, a lot of times what you will hear from them is that the job just got to be too much. You know, they'd seen too much, whether it's just random senseless violence or, you know, people that didn't make it out of a fire in time or, you know, whatever the thing is that kind of says, I can't watch this anymore. You know, I can't see this anymore and not be affected by it.
Children.
And so that notion is very much alive in the True Detective series. And the second season, not so much, but the first season is a beautiful deconstruction and repurposing of the idea that information is not necessarily good. And that when you shed a light on the darkness, you know, the downside is that you now see what you were not supposed to see. Yeah. And it is brilliantly realized in this story with a detective who lands a murder mystery and is saddled to work with someone who has already seen the darkness. Mm-hmm. And so the two of them have to find a way to work together, and I really don't want to give anything away. I don't want to give, but if you heard about it but haven't seen it, check it out. If anything that we've been talking about in this podcast has interested you, it's on HBO, which means you can get it on demand and things like that. Check it out. If you avoided it because you thought it was literally just a True Detective series, definitely check it out. The first season, it is one of the best, creepiest, most disturbing, most game changing interpretations of Lovecraftian that I've seen in a long, long time, and it's one of my all time favorite things in this type of story.
But do avoid the second season. Don't watch the second season.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least the first and second season are nothing at all like the first.
Yeah. First and second seasons are different stories, so you don't have to worry about. But I don't want to watch second season, so why should I watch first? They're different stories.
Different actors, everything. Yeah.
The second season is really good if you aren't expecting it to be like the first season. If you are expecting it to be like the first season, it is a crushing disappointment. Yeah, so kind of take that, you know, with a grain of salt. Anyways, that was my vibe. I think that one's just perfect.
Good one. That's an excellent one.
Well, but sometimes, as Mark said, ladies and gentlemen, when you look into the darkness, you see things you weren't meant to see. Other times, you look into the darkness, and the darkness can see you. So be careful out there.
Yep.
The Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and was written by Aaron DiOrive, Mark Finn, Mickey Finn, and Joseph Fotinos, with additional material produced by Abdul Ahazard, Herbert West, and Randolph Carter. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and the Gentleman Nerds mascot, The Unnameable, created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, and our special guest bartender was Agsosakosnuski. Our sound editor and accidental producer is Mickey Finn. Our executive producer and the man we all pray never gets the Necronomicon, Aaron DiOrive. Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hosting by Rustics Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher DiOrive. The Necronomicon first appeared in the short story The Hound, and Robert W. Chambers wrote The King in Yellow. Join us in the Lobot Lounge when next we open, and please always tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. This episode, ladies and gentlemen, of the Gentleman Nerds is lovingly dedicated to the memory of Mr. Martin Landau.
Pull the string! Pull the string!
Gentlemen, final words?
That which is not dead is not just a good idea. It's a watchword.
Mickey?
Yeah, y'all.
And Aaron?
Here's the proper way, by the way, to pronounce Cthulhu. We all say it Cthulhu, three syllables. That's not the way it's pronounced. The way it is supposed to be pronounced is like you're hawking a loogie. So pay attention. Here is how you say it. Cthulhu. Okay? One more time.
Ow.
Right in the eye. Is how you say Cthulhu. Thank you.
This is Joseph Fotinos reminding you all once again that Red Skull lives. You got me in the eye, Aaron, really.
It's true. You are supposed to sound like you are hacking something up and spitting it out.
Huh.
So that is how you pronounce Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those few instances where I will side on the side of pop culture. I think Cthulhu is much better.
Cthulhu is the Americanized, version.
I dated a girl who insisted that the pronunciation was like Neanderthal Cthulhu, but a tough sound.
Again, these are all just and they're fine. They're valid pronunciations, but they are not. This is not how his name was supposed to be pronounced.
Fun.
Yeah.
Now you know.
Hey, somebody turn the lights on in here.
The more you know is a bad idea in this case.
Yeah.